From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Iranians are protesting their government after it admitted to mistakenly downing a passenger plane last week, carrying 176 people. More than 100 of the fatalities were of Iranian nationals. The downing of the plane came just after the U.S. targeted a top Iranian military general in Iraq, Qasem Soleimani, in a provocative show of force that has pushed both countries to the brink of war. The Trump administration's justification for the airstrike was a claim of an Iranian plan to target U.S. embassies. But now that assertion is unraveling. A majority of Americans disapprove of Trump's handling of the crisis, according to a new poll. My guest is Reese Ehrlich. He is a veteran foreign correspondent. He's the author of a number of books about the Middle East and the War on Terror, including The Iran Agenda Today. His twice-monthly column called Foreign Correspondent appears in The Progressive. Welcome to the program, Reese.
Thank you so much.
So you and I have talked many times over the years about the U.S. being on the brink of war with Iran, but it seems as though this latest spat brought the U.S. closer to war with Iran than at any other time over at least a decade, would you say?
I'd say yes. The Trump, and it's the fault of the Trump administration. It's not like the Iranians had suddenly come up with some new aggression. The U.S. pulled out of the nuclear accord. It imposed crushing sanctions, which are hurting ordinary Iranians, and then expects nothing to happen other than perhaps the government to be overthrown and installing a new U.S. regime there. So we are much closer to a possible war. Luckily, a few days ago, tensions eased slightly, but the danger is still quite real.
So let's go over the timeline just briefly. This mainly started when the U.S. Launched a number of missile strikes at an Iranian-backed militia group in Iraq and in Syria as well. And that group then vowed to revenge those attacks. You had Iraqi protesters gathering at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. So this is not just a story about Iran, it's a story about Iraq as well. And then on January 3rd, the U.S. struck a target in Iraq, killing the Iranian general. The Iranian response to that was on January 7th when it struck two bases that housed U.S. forces in Iraq in retaliation for Soleimani's killing. Apparently, those forces, we now hear in news coverage on Monday, had about an hour to prepare and escape. But there were no U.S. or Iraqi casualties. So based on that Iranian military response, do you feel that it was calculated to show Iranian strength, but also not go so far as to push Iran into war with U.S.?
I think that's essentially correct. The Iranian government notified the Iraqi government in advance which bases they were going to attack in Iraq, which gave the Iraqis time to evacuate or take shelter. And I'm sure, and it's been mentioned in the mainstream press, that the Iraqi government warned the U.S. military. So that accounts for the fact that there was relatively, there were no casualties, according to the U.S. Whether the Iranians intentionally fired the missiles to land exactly where they did, that's, I think, less clear. Because the initial reports in the Iranian media were that there had been hundreds of casualties, or dozens of American casualties, and massive destruction of military equipment. So that would tend to indicate that they had intended, if not to kill people, at least to cause more significant destruction, and the missiles didn't hit their targets. But we frankly don't know that and may not know it for some time. The result, however, of the actual attacks was it gave the Trump administration an opportunity to back down. Trump went on TV, said, oh, no Americans were killed. The missiles were no big deal, so we're not going to escalate. And frankly, for whatever reason, that's a good thing, because the next step would be for the U.S. to attack Iran itself, and Iran would have to retaliate more significantly if that were to happen. Mm-hmm.
Before we get to the downing of the passenger plane, I want to focus a little bit on this claim around the intelligence that Trump says backed his decision to target Soleimani. We heard over the weekend NBC reporting that the plan to kill Soleimani was one of a number of military options that the U.S. military had essentially given Trump 7 months ago, that Trump had signed off on. And then 2 weeks ago, those options were made available to Trump, who signed off on the attack that killed Soleimani. And he said on January 9th, because they were looking to blow up our embassy, presumably he meant that U.S. embassy in Iraq that had been under siege. Then he said that four U.S. embassies, including the Baghdad embassy, were being targeted. But our own defense secretary, Mark Esper, said in an interview on Sunday that he did not have any direct intelligence suggesting that embassies were being attacked. Is this Trump's version of Bush's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?
That's exactly what I've written about in my column. Yes, the confusion, the constantly shifting stories, indicates that there was no imminent danger of an imminent attack. That's the story they came up with afterwards in order to justify it. It's going to go down in history as exactly the same argument as the weapons of mass destruction leading up to the Iraq War or the Gulf of Tonkin, the phony non-existent attacks on the U.S. Navy that started the Vietnam War or escalated the Vietnam War. The U.S. has a long history of not just the Trump administration, but a long history of other presidents lying to the American people, indicating that this war is going to be, or these actions are limited, and it's not leading to war or not leading to serious problems, and they always do. So yes, the Trump administration was lying on this one again.
There is also news or a report suggesting that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been behind the push to kill Soleimani, perhaps before John Bolton's resignation as National Security Advisor. It might have been Bolton, whose main political goal has been regime change in Iran. It might have been him pushing Trump to kill Soleimani, who knows. But Bolton's gone, and Pompeo seems to have emerged as that person within the Trump administration, aside from Trump himself, being the biggest hawk on Iran, right?
The Trump administration is riven with divisions in both tactical and strategic. And apparently, according to the New York Times, there were military leaders who were aghast at the idea of killing Soleimani because they realized what an impact that was going to have. Esper and
Pompeo,
thank you. We're definitely part of the hardliners within the administration. You know, we hear a lot about the hardliners in Iran and versus the reformists and so on. Well, there's a bigger political differences in Iran's leadership than there is in the U.S. I think what Pompeo was arguing for the hardline, but even the opponents were, it was a tactical difference. What impact is this going to have rather than is this legal or is this right? I think both sides in the White House completely miscalculated what the impact of this decision would be. And the people of Iraq are really, really angry about this assassination. And the Iraqi government is moving rapidly to demand the removal of all the U.S. troops from Iraq. And that's a huge political loss for the United States.
So Soleimani was being accused by the United States of being responsible for killing hundreds of U.S. troops in Iraq. He was also, I understand, responsible for essentially setting up, more broadly speaking, the Iranian-backed militias, such as the Houthi rebels in Yemen, a number of Iranian-backed militias in various countries, including Yemen, Iraq, Syria, etc. How would you explain his significance to an American audience?
Well, he was a very significant character and a very popular one in Iran. He was, the opinion polls showed him to be the second most popular political leader in Iran. And he was kind of a wartime hero. He was a hero in the Iran-Iraq War. He's set up various fighting forces in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq. And from the Iranian standpoint, that's a good thing. They're standing up to fight terrorism and they're fighting the US. Now, the reality, of course, is far different and far more complicated. What I have to say is that there is nothing but propaganda when it comes to the killing of US soldiers. The accusation is that the Iranians provided improvised explosive devices, IEDs, that were into the Iraq War and were responsible for the killing of hundreds of American soldiers. I've written about this. Stephen Zunis wrote an excellent article in a recent issue of The Progressive. Basically, those IEDs could be and were manufactured locally. They didn't need Iranian help to do that. It was part of the armed resistance to the US occupation. And it was also part of having to come up to blame somebody for things going so badly, so that you want to blame an outside power, and Iran provided a good example, a good excuse. Now, from the standpoint of many Iraqis, Lebanese, Syrians, Qasem Soleimani was advancing Iranian national interests and meddling in the region.
He was also essentially considered a war criminal.
By many. And why was that? Because those Iraqi militias that were trained by him engaged in all kinds of human rights abuses when they were fighting the Islamic State or ISIS. They shot peaceful demonstrators in recent demonstrations over the last couple of months that started in October. They have a horrible record on human rights, and you see, he was hated by many in Iraq. So it's neither the US version nor the Iranian version of who he was are actually accurate.
However, the decision to kill him is essentially an extrajudicial assassination that itself could be seen as a war crime, right? An attack on Iraqi sovereignty.
Absolutely. And the US is far more responsible for war crimes in the region than anybody else in all the other countries combined. Imagine, in fact, this has happened. The Iranian parliament has declared the US military to be a terrorist organization. Does that give them the right then to assassinate US military leaders anywhere in the world because they head up a terrorist organization? Well, that's essentially what the US has done by declaring the Revolutionary Guards a terrorist organization. It's unprecedented. Even in World War II, you didn't see this kind of activity. I'm referring specifically to Trump's threats to attack cultural sites. But you can't unilaterally, we're not at war with Iran, and you can't engage in this kind of assassination without it being a war crime or being a human rights crime. And keep in mind that the US was not only aiming to kill Soleimani, but there's another top al-Quds leader in Yemen that they targeted and they killed the wrong guy. So we only hear about the good news, but when things go awry, is the US going to be responsible for the murder of the wrong guy? Are they going to admit that they had done this and pay compensation? Certainly not. It's basically we're right because we've got the might.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of targeting cultural sites. That threat that Trump made, of course, reminded many of what the most backward, regressive, fundamentalist forces in the Middle East have engaged in and the Muslim world have engaged in, such as the Taliban's destruction of Afghanistan's cultural heritage, the ISIS destruction of Iraq's cultural heritage. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that Trump takes a page out of the Taliban and ISIS playbook.
He had to finally back down on that in the
Of course,
face
yeah.
of widespread controversy that it caused. But he did the same thing with torture. When he ran for election and when he first came into office, we're going to torture everybody that doesn't go along with us. If we need information, the guy has no sense of international relations, international law, international standards. He's a narcissist, and he's determined that an idea comes into his head, and he's gonna act it out, and that's a very, very dangerous situation for us and people in the world.
So how to make sense then of what came right after this back and forth around Soleimani's killing, which was the downing of the passenger airline, the Ukrainian Airlines flight from Iran. A majority of those killed on board were Iranians. Iran essentially said that initially that the flight path veered in the wrong direction, which prompted them to shoot it down. Now we know evidence shows very clearly that the plane did nothing. The pilots did absolutely nothing wrong. They were on the right trajectory. And Iran openly admitted to its mistakes. They seem to be showing a lot of regret over what happened, with one of the top generals saying that he wished he was on the flight because he regretted it so much. What do you think happened there?
Well, I think, first of all, it was a horrible tragedy. 176 people died, including many Iranians, as you mentioned. I think what happened was the shooting down of the civilian airliner took place just a couple hours after Iran had attacked, sent missiles into the U.S. bases in Iraq, and they thought they were under attack from a U.S. plane. And they fired a couple missiles, and they downed a civilian plane. So it was accidental. It was not intentional. But nevertheless, it has serious political, military, and other implications. For one thing, it really undercuts the Iranian image of having a efficient, albeit smaller, military than the United States. But the fact that they aimed at U.S. bases but didn't hit anything, and they shot down a civilian plane by mistake, calls into question how efficient and how sophisticated the Iraqi or the Iranian military really is. Even more importantly, there's people back in the streets now of Iran protesting what the shooting down of the plane and the, protesting the government. They had been protesting earlier. They stopped in light of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. In fact, there were massive millions of people out in the streets mourning him. And now they're gone and people are back in the streets protesting the government again. So politically and militarily, this is a serious, serious problem for the Iranian government.
So the Iranian government essentially lost a significant amount of the goodwill that it had perhaps earned back from its own people. And of course, before all of this, late last year, Iran was facing mass protests unrelated to what the U.S. had been doing, mass protests at home. And it was cracking down incredibly hard on those protests, killing dozens and dozens of people in the streets. Do you see this reaction against the downing of the passenger plane as a continuation of those protests from late last year?
I think it is. Remember, we have to put it in context. The U.S. sanctions on Iran are causing tremendous economic problems.
That's rarely mentioned in the Western media, so I'm glad you brought it up.
This is not just the Iranian people rising up against their evil, repressive government. It takes place in the context of an unprecedented crackdown of its sanctions and economic warfare against Iran. It's very difficult to get imported medicines, for example. Inflation is huge, rampant. Unemployment is rampant, at least a significant part because of the U.S. sanctions. But the Iranian government is also incompetent and mismanages and is corrupt. And people realize that. And I've done interviews for my column with ordinary Iranians who say, yes, we oppose absolutely what the U.S. is doing, and we realize the impact it has, but the corruption and mismanagement are a tremendous problem here. And those folks who were demonstrating last year, who went on hiatus during the Soleimani mourning period, are now back in the streets protesting that corruption and mismanagement.
Now, the Trump administration, and of course Trump himself, is maybe this is wishful thinking, but he's praised the protesters, and of course anti-Iranian protests within the country are often taken advantage of by American hawks in Iran. But does it mean that those protesters who are against their own very clearly repressive government are also pro-U.S.?
No, it's not. When I go to Iran, and I've been there 10 times now, it's very hard to find anybody who thinks the U.S. is doing good stuff or is helpful for Iran.
But there's, many are critical, I imagine, of their own government.
Yeah, they're very critical of their own government. I mean, there's a small number of monarchists, you know, who want to see the Shah or the son of the Shah come back. There's a small number of others who, particularly in the ethnic minority communities, who look favorably on the U.S. But the vast majority of Iranians are not interested in having a pro-U.S. regime in power. They went through that once. They had a democratic government in 1953 under Mossadegh. The U.S. and the British overthrew that government, installed the dictatorial Shah, imposed horrific human rights abuses, and that led directly to the 1979 revolution. So the Iranians have had direct and firsthand experience with what it means to have a pro-U.S. regime. It's not democracy. It protects the interests of the U.S. oil companies and the arms manufacturers and the other corporations, and has nothing to do with helping the ordinary people. Now, if the government were to change in Iran, it would be neither the kind it has now, nor would it be linked up to the United States.
There have been mass protests here in the United States against a U.S.-Iran war. At the very moment when it seemed as though the tensions were escalating, both in Washington, D.C. and in smaller cities around the country. Do you think that those protests have had an impact, or is Trump a president who campaigned on being non-interventionist, essentially acting in his own interest?
I think they have an impact to the extent that Trump worries about his base abandoning him. And, you know, when you talk on KPFA or Free Speech Radio or others, we tend to reach the progressives, people on the left. But there's a significant number of people on the right, both libertarians and just ordinary people, who don't want to see more wars in the Middle East. They don't want to see more troops killed and more trillions of dollars spent. And the more that people are out in the streets and the more diverse and wider those protests are, the more impact it's going to have, not only on Trump individually, but on his administration. Above all else, he wants to stay in power. He wants to win the election by whatever means necessary in this year. And the degree to which there's massive protests against him and against those policies are going to have a significant impact.
Reese, finally, how significant is the War Powers Resolution that the House passed recently with, of course, majority Democratic support, curbing Trump's ability to go to war in Iran without congressional approval? Trump has essentially painted Democrats as being pro-Iranian regime, you know, backing war criminals and backing repression. He even tweeted a horrendous picture of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi with a turban and a hijab, respectively, saying that they are coming to the Ayatollah's rescue. But how important is that resolution?
Well, on a political and a symbolic level, it's very important. You may recall that there was practically no invoking of the War Powers Act up until Trump's ascendancy to power. And it passed in the House. They passed one resolution calling for an end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen and ending U.S. support for Saudi Arabia, and now one against the war in Iran. In the past, the Democrats, unfortunately, the mainstream of the Democratic Party, were supporting the war efforts, for example, in Iraq. So I think it's significant that the majority, the vast majority of Democrats in the House and in the Senate are opposed on some level to what the U.S. is doing now in Iran. But as a practical matter, it's not going to pass the Senate. There's some debate in the Senate about a different resolution. We'll have to see if there's enough Republicans abandon the Trump on this issue and vote in favor of some kind of war powers resolution. But if they do, Trump can veto it, and there doesn't seem to be any likelihood of overcoming a veto in the Senate. But as I said, the fact that it's even introduced and the fact that the Democratic Party, including the mainstream Democrats, are opposed to this action in Iran, that's very, very significant. And hopefully pressure from below will keep the Democrats honest and shift enough Republican votes as well.
Right. Hopefully they'll remember their anti-war sentiments when there's a Democrat in the White House and or Democratic majority in the Senate. Reese, we'll post a link to your latest article about Iran from our website. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Reese Erlich is a veteran foreign correspondent, author of a number of books about the Middle East and the War on Terror, including The Iran Agenda Today. His twice monthly column called Foreign Correspondent appears in The Progressive. We've been discussing the U.S.-Iran conflict. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.